This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The week that was, of course, we will go buy a little gas, natural gas, and Russia, Ukraine, and sanctions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today. This one is the 21st of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do a little jobs as we review the week that was. Maybe a little bit of politics of this economy. We'll talk about the Fed and, okay, fine, yes, the markets too. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Sadeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you too.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Sadeep, let me start with you, and I'm going to pick on you just because you are physically in Washington, although you are not a member of the White House press corps. I need you to help me understand why the White House press corps, an incredibly hardworking bunch who knows a lot, why at presidential press conferences like the one President Biden had this week, why do they ask things like, what are you going to do about inflation, when he really can't?
Because that is what is on the minds of most Americans right now. And that is where I will put the defense for the White House press corps there. This is the thing that is dragging us down. This is the malaise that's showing up in Biden's approval ratings. It's the thing that we're all talking about and thinking about. And Joe Biden, to his credit, did something. All of us Fed nerds were like, whoa, he actually said that. He created the permission structure out loud and said the Fed is going to have to take care of this. And it is the political handover to say the Fed, you know, Fed's going to have to raise interest rates and create some turmoil. And we're seeing that in financial markets and what some of that turmoil looks like, a taste of it. But he was also saying part of this is due to monetary policy being easy. And he was also sending some of the blame to the Fed for keeping things so good for the last 2 years in trying to clean up the mess from the pandemic.
Yeah, quite the change, Lynette, right, from the Trump administration and the Federal Reserve to Biden saying, hey, do what you got to do.
But at the same time, you know, the Fed can only do so much because the Fed can't do anything about what's going on in shipping, and the Fed can't do anything about China shutting down ports or cities because of the virus, and the Fed can't do anything about the lack of truckers on the road. There's so many things that are contributing to inflation that are completely out of the president and the Fed's hands because they're part of globalization and the global supply chain. And this is how we designed the world for the last 40 years. So it's going to take a little while for these kinks to be smoothed out. But of course, yeah, Biden wants someone to blame. The American people want someone to blame. And unfortunately, there really isn't a good person to blame.
Hey, Sadeep, I don't want to get too far down into the weeds of the federal funds rate, but there is some chatter, some speculation, some perhaps uninformed speculation that maybe the Fed will go, oh, my goodness, we have to raise rates 0.5% when we do it next year. Do you put any stock in that?
I think they're probably going to be discussing that at their meeting.
Wow.
Do they need to accelerate the pace of increase? I do not think Jay Powell is going to come out and say, actually, just kidding, instead of doing this at quarter point. But the Fed has actually laid the groundwork. Once it finally decided to pull back this extraordinary accommodation, it's done it relatively quickly. It's laid the groundwork. We know there's going to be some pain in 401ks. We know there's going to be some turbulence when that happens, but they do signal their actions in advance. And they did a pretty quick turnaround in the fall to signal those actions. And so it does seem like sometime this year, half a point increases could be on the table, but a lot depends on how much effect they have from some of these early signals that they're sending right now, because they can keep nudging this direction, but they don't want to break anything. And that's the concern right now, is breaking stuff.
Yeah. I'm going to take breaking stuff, Sudeep, to mean at least in part the markets, right? And Lynette, I need to give a shout out to a tweet you had, I guess, yesterday or maybe the day before, as the markets were doing what they've been doing all week, which is going down. And you said, when are people going to realize that the markets are just puking? I think was your technical term.
That is a very technical term.
It is a very technical term. You're a longtime Wall Street observer. But it's kind of what's supposed to be happening, right? Rates are going to go up. We're going to take a little air out of equities, and that's the way it's going to go for a while.
Yeah. I mean, get really worried when I start tweeting out the words like splat. and you know, like crush and stuff like that. So then you should worry. But you know, the rest of America doesn't necessarily need to worry about this. If you're holding stocks for the long term, if you're below the age of 50, you don't need to worry about this because the market will come back. But we do know that it has been incredibly inflated since the beginning of the pandemic. Some crazy things have happened that I won't even discuss here. And you know, it's time for things to get back to normal. And that's going to cause a lot of pain for a lot of people who just entered and started playing the market kind of like junkies during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But for most Americans who are going to enjoy the economy that is in fact growing and a pandemic that is hopefully ending, this is not going to be a huge deal.
Okay, so fair enough. But to that point, Sudeep, about the pandemic hopefully ending, yes, we hopefully are ending, or at least getting to the endemic part of this pandemic. But the labor market is still like, wait a minute, Omicron, I can't go to work. First-time claims for unemployment benefits went up last week to the level that they were at in October, which granted was still relatively low. But we ain't done with this.
You know, every time we think we're done with it, we thought we were done with it last spring, and obviously Delta hit and then Omicron hit. And we can all hope that there won't be another surprise like this. I'm not sure any of us can take it, right? We're all losing our minds. But like there are some signs that this is going to be a different phase of what we're dealing with COVID. And if that happens, then we can slowly expect some healing. But a lot of things have fundamentally changed in this period. People have reevaluated their lives in new ways, and the labor market is going to have to go through years of adjustment from all of this, and it's not going to be easy. All of these things that we're seeing with difficulty hiring workers, eventually we'll get addressed, some of it through technology, but it's going to be years of adjustment to this dislocation, and I don't think we've even begun to get our heads around all of that.
Lynette, you agree with that?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
Lynette Lopez, she's a Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy, he's at Politico. My goodness. All right, thanks, you two. Have a nice afternoon.
Thanks, weekend.
Kat. Happy weekend, everybody. On Wall Street today, stocks do go down too, y'all. I know you don't want to believe it, but it's true. Lynette Lopez says so. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to do a story now about time, and industrial policy. Intel announced today it's going to spend $20 billion to build two new semiconductor factories near Columbus, Ohio, leaning in to solving the signature shortage of this pandemic economy, the chips that go into basically everything now. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, sometimes no matter how much money you throw at something, you can't get what you want when you want it.
It takes a long time to build any factory and get it up and running.
First off, you have to build the factory. You have to dig the hole. You have to build the shell of the factory.
Alan Priestley is an analyst at Gartner. He says it takes even longer when that factory is making semiconductor chips, because you have to install all the extremely complex equipment that produces the chips.
And then you have to turn the factory on
and run it for a while to be sure it's actually working and producing high-quality chips. And even then, once it finally is...
It takes time to make a chip, right? To process a wafer from the start of putting a wafer into the factory to getting a wafer out that has chips on it can take 2 to 3 months.
So Priestley says it'll likely be 2 or 3 years, maybe even 4, before you can buy something that includes a chip made at one of these new factories.
I don't think this announcement by Intel is really about the short-term problem. I think it's about the long-term.
Willie Shi at Harvard Business School says in the short term, the semiconductor chip shortage should start to ease later this year or next.
As a lot of the capacity investments that were made last year start to come on stream.
And once the current shortage is resolved, Glenn O'Donnell at Forrester Research says in the long term, when these Intel plants are up and running, there will likely be even more demand than there is now for the chips they produce.
We human beings have an insatiable appetite for smart everything. We want smart cars. We want smart appliances. We want smart toys.
And that means more and more chips. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with his Russian counterpart in Geneva today, the latest in a long series of meetings about Ukraine. Putin has tanks on the ground over there, troops as well. The White House and European allies have made it pretty clear their economic sanctions are about as far as they are willing to go. But the catch is that since the annexation of Crimea and Russia's cybersecurity threats and its election interference, plenty of sanctions have already been levied on Moscow. So now what do you suppose Biden does? Eddie Fishman's at the Center for New American Security. Also, he's an Obama State Department veteran. Welcome to the program. It's good to have you on.
Thanks, Kai. Great to be here.
So as you just heard, and as you know, there is already a pile of sanctions on Russia. Put yourself in the mind of Secretary of State Blinken and his policy planning staff, and talk to me about what you think they might be considering now.
The most important thing to know is that the sanctions in place in Russia today are still relatively modest. I think there is this misconception that Russia has a lot of sanctions that have been applied to it. Yeah. The truth is there was a big first wave of sanctions in 2014, but they really haven't been ratcheted up too much in the last 8 years. What the Biden administration could do today is impose what are called full blocking sanctions on Russian banks and companies. Those are the sanctions that actually cut off a bank from the entire U.S. financial system. And it does seem like if Russia did make the decision to invade Ukraine, the Biden administration would be ready to impose some full blocking sanctions on Russian banks and companies.
And certainly the White House, the president himself, and Secretary of State Blinken have been talking the talk. But it occurs to me that these sanctions do not come without cost to the United States and conceivably our allies if we can get them to go along, which is a whole other question I'll get to in a minute.
That's exactly right. And I think this is probably the biggest debate that's going on internally within the Biden administration, because if you are going to actually be ready to impose full blocking sanctions on Sberbank, which is the largest bank in Russia, or impose sanctions that would affect Russia's ability to export oil, which of course would be a major escalation in penalties, they're going to affect the global economy and certainly Europe and maybe even the United States. So I think what we have to look at, though, Kai, is the goal now is to avert a major war in Europe. And we should be prepared to absorb some political, economic, and diplomatic costs if what we're going to get is deterring a war.
Well, all right. So the mention of a land war in Europe, which just it seems to me incredible that we're actually, you know, using those words, right? You have to get the Europeans on board. And there are 27 members of the European Union. They have to act in concert to impose sanctions. What do you think? Spitball that for me.
Sure. And I think, you know, up until now, the U.S., certainly during the Obama administration and during the Biden administration, has put a premium on coordination with the EU. And I think that's really important because I think one of Putin's goals, in addition to, you know, bringing Ukraine into his sphere of influence, is to divide the transatlantic community. But I would be surprised if the European Union is willing to go as far as it will, you know, require to deter Russia with sanctions. So I think that the Biden administration is going to have to be willing to act alone and faster than Europe if it really is going to impose the type of sanctions that are required to deter Russia.
I heard the other day on a different public radio program, whose initials are All Things Considered, that and it was, in fact, it was Alexander Vindman, who we all know from the impeachment trials. He said that Russia has been hardening itself against sanctions since 2014, that Putin probably had some inkling that he was going to do this and that we were going to do that. Do you buy that hardening notion?
It's definitely the case that Russia has become more resilient to sanctions. The sanctions, like I said, that were put in place in 2014 weren't all that strong, and they still sent the Russian economy into a tailspin. The ruble collapsed. Russia, had a significant contraction in GDP. What Putin has done in the interim is really rebuilt the Russian economy. They now have foreign exchange reserves in excess of $600 billion. That said, they're not invulnerable to sanctions. And certainly if the Biden administration was willing to actually use the sanctions tools that the United States possesses, it could send the Russian economy into a tailspin again, Mm-hmm. So, yes, Russia is more resilient to sanctions, but they're certainly not invulnerable to them.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go. The United States is the biggest, most powerful economy in the world, at least for now. And the Chinese are coming up fast, right? But for now, we're it. And yet economic sanctions are just so hard to do, and often they don't work, right?
That is true. And I think that's because sanctions are not a silver bullet. They're extremely effective at imposing economic pain. The United States could unilaterally, by itself, at the stroke of a pen, impose devastating economic consequences on Russia. The real question is, to what end? Will those consequences change Putin's calculus? And many times the answer is no. And I think that's what we're all waiting to see right now, Kai.
Eddie Fishman, he was in the State Department in the Obama administration, also now at the Center for New American Security, and also Columbia and the Atlantic Council. Mr. Fishman, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Coming up,
we price gas depending on when you want it.
I want it right now. What's it going to cost me? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, no. The Dow Industrial is down 450 points today. 1 3/10% closed at 34,265. The NASDAQ gave up 385 points, just shy of 2 3/4%, 13,768. The S&P 500 down 84 points. 1.9%, finished at 43.97. For the week, we should do the Wawa's just for the week, actually. The Dow gave up 4.6%, the NASDAQ down 7 6/10%, the S&P 500 down 5.7%. So what do you suppose traders thought of that $20 billion in new factory investment from Intel that Samantha Fields was telling us about? Yeah, not so much. Apparently, Intel basically unchanged today. Competitor NVIDIA gave up 3 2/10%. Broadcom down about 2.6%. Netflix and chill, yeah, I don't think so. Down almost 22% today after it reported, as we noted yesterday on the program, subscriber growth isn't growing. Streaming company also said is facing more competition. Duh. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I went to an Adele concert maybe 3-4 years ago. It was amazing. She puts on a great show. So That video that she posted yesterday saying she is postponing her residency at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas that was supposed to start today because too many of her crew members have COVID and for what she called delivery delays in getting the show to where it wants it to be, that rings true. That rings true. It's a lot of work. And the fact is that with Omicron still surging, live performances of all kinds are suffering. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on that one for us.
Adele let her fans know about the postponement on Instagram.
And I'm gutted. I'm gutted, and I'm sorry it's the last minute.
Last minute, as in the night before the opening. And she's getting some flack for making such a last-minute decision. But Dana Frank, CEO of First Avenue, a music venue in Minneapolis, says this is how the business works these days.
We've canceled shows a week before, an hour before, even 10 minutes after doors open. We're all figuring this out. There are no rules because no one in our industry has ever had to handle this before.
She says sometimes it's the artist's choice. Sometimes it's the venue's. Most often, it's a joint decision, a reluctant one. Frank says before a show even begins, the venue's already spent a quarter of the budget on marketing, equipment rentals, and staging. But sometimes there's no choice.
Having too many staff out on quarantine to open the doors or artists themselves getting positive test results, you know, 20 minutes before they're supposed to go on stage.
That's what recently troubled Broadway shows, which have been heavily relying on understudies. Charlotte St. Martin, president of the trade association, the Broadway League, says there were times when even backups were out sick.
If the cast or crew, anybody in the cast or crew is test positive and we don't have a replacement for them, then we do not go on.
It's made some performers scale back production values. Dave Pomeroy is a musician and president of the Nashville Musicians Association. He says many artists are keeping sound, lighting, and stage crews small.
The bigger the tour, the more complicated it can be.
The show must go on. That is, if it can dodge Omicron. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The discussion of energy prices on this program revolves almost entirely around oil. And I mean, that one's really on me, right? I just figure it's easier for you to visualize a barrel of oil when I tell you how much it costs, a barrel of oil, right? But we keep track of natural gas prices too. And wrapping your brain around that is a little trickier because gas is more amorphous, right? Odorless, colorless, just vaporous. So we had our man on energy, Andy Euler. Dig into nat gas pricing.
With natural gas, we're not talking about barrels full of a liquid.
They trade in BTUs, which stands for British Thermal Units.
That's Job Harry from the financial services company Stone X. A BTU is the amount of heat required to raise the temperature of 1 pound of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit. Now, that's not a lot of energy. Your average gas oven uses 16,000 BTUs per hour. The price you typically hear for natural gas is a million BTUs. And like oil's Brent crude and West Texas Intermediate, that price has a name.
The benchmark U.S. natural gas futures contract is typically the Henry Hub contract in Louisiana.
That's Eugene Kim. He's a research director with Wood Mackenzie's North America Gas team. The Henry Hub is a distribution hub on the natural gas pipeline system in Erath, Louisiana. Really, it's just a name. There's another important variable that goes into the price of gas.
We price gas depending on when you want it.
Nico Safos is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If you want gas now, that's one price. If you want it in a month, that's a different price. If you want it in 6 months or a year, that's a different price. And for all of those moments in time, there's a supply and a demand for gas to be delivered at that time.
More often than not, when people are talking about the price of gas, they're talking about the price for delivery 1 month from now. But sometimes you need it sooner. Richard Meyer is a vice president at the American Gas Association.
We also have a spot price of natural gas. And the spot price is also called the cash price. This is what you would pay for natural gas to be delivered to you today.
Sometimes those prices get out of whack. And so companies that use a lot of natural gas buy contracts at a lot of different lengths to literally hedge their bets. Frank Beeling consults electricity providers for a company called Guernsey in Oklahoma City.
Utilities try to sort of arrange for their fuel supply ahead of time in advance, and they want to do it in a way where it's, you know, reliable, that they're able to get it when they need it.
And at a price that's relatively predictable. Now, there's one final variable in the price of gas. How far is the gas user from the source? Gas is cheaper closer to where it's produced, or at least close to a pipeline. But in that regard, some places are out of luck. Again, Eugene Kim at Wood Mackenzie.
The global gas markets, especially in Europe, are facing a undersupply situation.
While a monthly contract for 1 million BTUs of natural gas in Henry Hub is running you less than $4 right now, the price at an equivalent site in the Netherlands is closer to $30. Kim says U.S. producers are desperate to increase their export capacity. And with many developing countries switching from coal to natural gas for heating and electricity, that export market is likely to expand even further. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, either has impeccable timing or he just got lucky. Adams, who has said he wants to turn New York into a cryptocurrency hub, said a couple of months ago he's going to take his first three paychecks in Bitcoin and Ether. Well, it turns out by statute, the mayor's got to be paid in dollars, but his office said he is going to convert those paydays right over to crypto. Which is my entree to tell you that today, payday for New York City employees, Bitcoin is off 6.5%. So the mayor is clearly buying the dip. The catch, of course, is that for the month, Bitcoin is down 22%. That's always my test with people who want to buy Bitcoin. Would you take your paycheck in it? Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A quick follow to Euler's spot. It's more random economic trivia, really. Did you know that a barrel of oil is only 42 gallons? For the longest time, until I got this job, really, I just assumed it was your standard 55-gallon drum, which it is not. So now you know. All right, our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.